Yes, I'm going to continue the exploration of the Sanger Jewel. And just maybe I should say a little bit about myself. So I work at the LBC. I've been working at the LBC maybe about 12 or 13 years. And I have particular, I have all sorts of different responsibilities at the LBC, but one of the responsibilities I have is to create conditions for men to come together and explore the Dharma. So Subhadramati is the other version, if you sort of mean, for the women. But I do that for the men. So I'm quite involved in Sangha, basically, and trying to cultivate the conditions for everybody, really, to come together. But I'm mainly focused on men. So I'm going to say a bit about the historical Sangha. I'm going to say a bit about how the Sangha come to be initially. Then I'm going to broaden out and talk about the Sangha more generally, and more specifically about the Tree Ratna Sangha, because that's the Sangha that I've always been involved in. I've not been involved in any other Sangha. And then I'm going to talk about the qualities of the Sangha jewel. So I'm going to talk about the jewel in terms of its rarity, beauty, and value. That's how I'm going to approach That's how I'm going to approach the jewel, rarity, beauty, and value. Yes, I'll get onto those in a minute. So, firstly, so how did the original Buddhist Sangha come into being? So, the first real Buddhist Sangha, were the friends of the Buddha. Well, actually, it was like a pre-Sangha. So the Buddha, before he was enlightened, Siddhartha Gautama, was practicing the practices, the disciplines of his time. And he was doing that with his friends, basically. And the practices he was practicing were disciplines, they were basically the ascetic practices that were around at that time. So maybe these ascetic practices were, you might stand up, put your arm up in the air for a month or something like that. Or you might sort of sleep outside naked or something. But the Buddha was particularly noted for living on one grain of rice a day. Apparently that's what he did. And he was very severe in these practices. He was revered for those practices, particularly by his immediate friends. But the Buddha eventually rejected that path, and he went off on his own, away from his friends. He left his friends, basically, and because he intuited that the way to enlightenment wasn't that through that path. And luckily, the Buddha discovered the way to enlightenment. We're pleased to announce. The Buddha. So the Buddha had this experience, and a very profound experience, and he realized that it was a very subtle kind of experience, and he wasn't sure whether he was going to be able to communicate this to other people. But apparently in the enlightenment experience itself, there is a need to communicate it. So he wondered who he could communicate it to, and he did reflect on this for a while, whether he could actually do this or not. So what he decided he was going to do was go and find his friends that he'd done these ascetic practices with. So he went and found his friends. And he started to communicate the Dharma to them. And one by one, they began to understand what he understood himself. And the Sangha jewel was born, basically. The Sangha jewel was born. So the three refuges were complete: the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, or the three jewels, as we say. So that's the original Sangha. That's how the original Sangha come to be. Yeah, the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma as well. That's often what it's called at that moment. And this Sangha was called the Aryan Sangha, the noble Sangha. So this is the Sangha of those that understand what the Buddha understands. So that's what they were known as first. And they were separated out from, in Indian culture at that time, they would delineate between those that knew and those that didn't know. Okay, so the Aryan Sangha were the people that understood what the Buddha understood, and the ordinary folk, as they were said to be, didn't understand what the Buddha understood, but they were trying to understand that. So there was a difference between these two groups. So that was the beginnings of the Sangha. So the more general use of the term these days, Sangha, is really anybody that's practicing the Dharma is part of the Sangha, the big sort of umbrella of the Sangha. But there is a distinction made between the different Sanghas. So there may, if you practice in a Tibetan group, that will be a particular Sangha, maybe a Thich Nhat Hanh Sangha, or the Triratna Sangha. So there are all these different Sanghas that we refer to, but you can say that they're all part of the big wider, as it were, Sangha. And these, as it were, smaller Sanghas, they have particular emphases, and the Triratna has particular emphases. I'm going to talk about a particular emphasis of the Triratna Sangha in a minute. But we can basically say that people in the Triratna Sangha, or the Triratna Buddhist community or order, they have at the heart of their life the three jewels. That's basically what that means, that's the centre of their life. And they arrange their life around those jewels. So now I want to move on to the Sangha as a jewel and use that jewel as a metaphor, just so that we can explore the qualities of the Sangha in our imagination, a bit like what Vidyadharka was doing last night. So I'm going to do that in three ways, as I said. I'm talking about its rarity, its beauty, and its value. So we can talk about a jewel as being elusive and rare and hard to find the real thing. Yeah? So jewels and diamonds are made under very, very unusual conditions, and they take a long time to develop. They're difficult to find. And jewels are multifaceted. If you look at a jewel when it's been cut by a jeweler, it's got all these different edges to it. It's multi-faced. And however you look at a jewel, if you hold it up to the light, it looks magical and it looks bright and beautiful. It catches our attention. They can be fascinating to look at. You can just look at them with wonder. So this is some of the symbolism of the Sangha jewel. So how do these metaphors sort of chunk down in our everyday kind of experience? So I can only talk about the Triratna Sangha because I've not been involved in any other Sangha. I come to the LBC and immediately responded and thought, this is it. I've never shopped around anywhere else. So I can only talk about the Triratna Sangha. So in my view, the Sanghas are very, very rare and precious. It's very, very precious to me, and I can see that it's precious to other people as well. And it's precious because it helps us fulfill our potential. Yeah, it helps us fulfill our potential. So one of the points that Sangha Achta makes in his book, What is the Sangha? We haven't got any books here, I don't think, have we, Ollie? What, Bant is out of print. You might be able to get a copy somewhere. But Sangha Achta says something like that we are, and I'm referring to our potential here, and how we fulfill our potential. He says that we are so affected by the conditions that we've been surrounded by since birth that our thoughts, our views, our ideas are not our own. In his words, he says that we are members of a group, and that we are instinctively a pack animal. So we seek security in the pack and in the group. And we think we're really smart and unique, but we're probably not. So that might be something to reflect on. But Buddhism would say that we are unique, actually. It would say that we are unique, but we don't really understand what that means, probably. just yet. So as group members, we're told we have our own minds. We're told we have our own minds. But when we take on the perspective of having been so conditioned by all the things that have surrounded us since birth, we may come to the conclusion, or may ask the question, whose mind have I got anyway? If I've taken on everybody else's views and thoughts and ideas, whose mind have I got? Whose mind is this? And you may find this when you meditate. The more you meditate, the more you realise that the fact that we're just not in control of our own mind. Things just keep arising in the mind. We don't know why they arise, but they all these thoughts and ideas and views keep arising in the mind. So we might wonder, whose mind have we actually got? And this can be a bit of a frightening thought. Just realizing that we're not in charge, but it can be equally liberating. Actually, you can turn that round, because we're so identified with our thoughts and our emotions that we can take a different perspective on it. So we're sort of basically the product of our conditions. That means that we can change our mind. We can change things. We can just change the conditions and our mind will follow. Our mind will follow suit. So that's important. But I think it is really important to ask the question, do we really know what we think and feel about certain things? Have we really thought things through? Do we really know what we want from life? Have we really reflected on what life means and what it's for? So group conditioning doesn't usually get you to ask these questions because it's basically a threat to the security of the group. The group doesn't want us to break free. The group doesn't want us to break free. And in relationship to freedom, it's interesting group thinking around this. So the Buddha said something like the Dharma has one taste. He says it's like the ocean. Wherever you go in the world and you taste the ocean, it tastes of salt, as we know. And he says the Dharma's like this. He says the Dharma has one taste, and it has the taste of freedom. And if you're a group member, you're not free. You may think that you're free, but you're not free. So I think freedom is a bit of an obsession in Western culture. You know, we talk about liberty, freedom, and freedom of expression. And I wanted to raise this point in relationship to responsibility. Because it's one thing being free, it's one thing thinking that you're free, but you need to be responsible with that freedom. And people often complain about their right to expression, freedom of expression, but you don't hear anyone complaining about the right to be responsible. And I wanted to raise this in relationship to the thing that's happened in France recently or a few years back with these Charlie Hebdo cartoons, cartoons of Muhammad the prophet, which I think there was an unfortunate idea or view in there that they, you know, you need to be able to express yourself regardless of the consequences. And I think that's a really, really big mistake. And I think that's just a group think, basically. You think you're free to express yourself, but what about responsibility? So responsibility is a quality of a true individual. The Sangha doesn't really need to be governed by rules or regulations. All you need is responsibility and taking on responsibilities, basically having an ethical outlook on life in relationship to freedom. But you may say that, you may think that isn't being part of a spiritual community or a Sangha just being part of another group? Well, yes and no. So Sangha actually goes into this in his book. He talks about needing to be part of a positive group. So a positive group, in his coinage, is a group that does contain true individuals or they are at the centre, and those true individuals are enabling you to grow free of the group conditioning. So yes and no, if you're in the Sangha, it is a group, but we try to we're trying to fulfil our potential. So the Sangha jewel is rare, just to come back to rarity. The Sangha jewel is rare because it's nothing like that you've come across before in relationship to it helping you grow and develop and help you transcend your group conditioning and help others to do the same. So that's rarity. Now I want to say something about beauty. Beauty of the jewel, yeah? So there's something that sets the Sangha apart, and it's Kalyana Mitrata. I don't know whether Abhayan Andy mentioned this. Kalyana Mitrata. So Kalyana means beautiful or lovely. And Mitrata means friend. Kalyana Mitrata. So these are friendships that are based basically on metta. Yeah? On metta, on loving kindness. And they're friendships that just encourage the best. So we encourage the best in one another. And this is one of the emphases of the Tri Ratna community. It's a distinct emphasis. And it's entirely traditional. So the Buddha was said to have said this. His cousin Ananda, who was also his attendant for many years, said to the Buddha once that half of the Dharma life, half of practicing the Dharma was Kalyana Mitrata. So the Buddha said, no, Ananda, that's not so. He said the whole of the spiritual life is Kalyana Mitrata. It's quite a thing to say. The whole of it is spiritual friendship. So the Sangha embodies metta. That's what draws out our true uniqueness, and not to serve the group. So we're not part of a Sangha to serve that group. So as we rely more and more on the Sangha to help us grow out of our group conditioning into a true individual, the Dharma starts to respond to us via the Sangha, if you see what I mean. It starts to respond to us in the areas that we need to grow. So it's as if the Sangha embodies a kind of discriminating wisdom. It starts to respond to you sort of individually. Early on when you come to the Dharma, you can think it's a one size fits all. But as you practice, you realise that the Sangha starts to respond to you and you start to grow. So it starts to respond to you as an individual. It's a really interesting process. One of the ways you can first notice that is when somebody's maybe giving a talk to a room of people. And, of course, the speaker's trying to talk to you individually, but suddenly something comes over you and it really feels like they're talking to you individually. It's almost like they're making a point right to where it needs to go right now, if you see what I mean. So that's one way you can start to feel like the Dharma's talking to you personally. Another way is once you start to get to know people in the Sangha, it's as if they know you better than you know yourself. And they start to point things out to you. It's a bit of a surprise sometimes when they say things, this and that, or you need to do this or you need to do that. Or they rejoice in your qualities. That can be a bit of a surprise. And it's a real boon if people have got your best interests at heart that they know you well. So this is all in the context of Kalyana Mitrata. So metta is a defining quality of the Sangha, and it's the basis of for the antidote of the negative states that the group have, that the group sort of encourage, which can be envy, manipulation, control, colluding, complaining, gossiping, moaning, blaming. These are all the negative states that we can find in the group dynamic. So instead of feeling envious towards people in the Sangha, somebody's got good qualities or they've had some good fortune, we rejoice in that. We let metta overflow in rejoicing. Or if we come across suffering, people that suffer, people inside and outside the Sangha, not just inside the Sangha. So we don't take a kind of moral superiority in relationship to those people. We empathise. We don't blame them for their suffering. We don't take pity on them. We don't turn away frightened. We can stay engaged. If we're cultivating metta, a deep empathy will just arise naturally. So these are the qualities of Kalyanamitrita, and they're synonymous with the quality of metta. I mean, I was just reflecting on this. I mean, isn't this what we really need in our life? I know I need this. And I just think here we're being presented with a vision, a way to live. And right now I really think we need a different kind of vision in the world about the way the world can be, instead of getting caught up in group dynamics and people fighting, etc. So that's beauty. And now we'll come on to value. And then I'll finish off. So perhaps I don't need to say much about value. Maybe it's obvious from what I've been saying, that the Sangha jewel is of great value. It's priceless. It's precious. If we do value Sangha, one thing we can do to value it is participate in it. We shouldn't leave it up to other people. We need to really engage with the Sangha to make it happen. We can do this in all sorts of different ways. We can do this by engaging at our centre, all sorts of different ways of practicing generosity. We can come on retreat. We can live in a Buddhist community. We can work with other Buddhists. There are all sorts of ways of engaging with the Sangha so that we can create these kind of spiritual friendships where we can thrive and other people can thrive. We can jointly grow together. So yeah, participating in it is a kind of valuing it and looking after it. But I think its ultimate value, Sangha, is that it raises the level of consciousness of those that participate in it. So if you participate in it, you're going to be lifted up. It's as simple as that. So the more you participate, the more you grow. And Sangharakshita makes an interesting point here. He says something like that. So when a group of people come together, when a group of Buddhists come together and they practice intensively, a new order of consciousness can emerge. A new order of consciousness. Sometimes he calls it the third order of consciousness. So in other words, when we come together and practice, and we're practicing like this now, we kind of create a conduit in which the Buddha can move down towards us. So these are the part of the conditions Subhadramati was talking about, a kind of a transcendental force. One way of approaching the Buddha is inviting the Buddha to come down towards us or move towards us through cultivating the conditions. Or another way of talking about it is like a blessing. We're at Adhisthana. I don't know why Bansi called this place Adhisthana. Sangharakshita called this place Adhisthana. But it means blessing. And I suspect he may have that in mind. I don't know. A place of intensive practice where blessings can come down and this different order of consciousness can emerge. And as I say, we're doing that right now. We're doing that on retreat. My experience of doing these retreats, they're quite intensive. This one in particular is that if we all keep engaging with the program and keep engaging with the meditation practice, something magical starts to emerge. So I hope you can keep staying engaged with the retreat and see if you can get a sense of the magic of this jewel. So I'll conclude. So I've talked about the history of the Sangha. I've talked about the Aryan Sangha, the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma. I've talked about Sangha more generally, and I've explored the Dharma jewel in terms of its rarity, beauty and value. And I've talked about this kind of elevation of consciousness, this new consciousness that can emerge when we come together collectively and practice. I'll leave it there.